Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
You are listening to Troubadours and Raconteurs with E.W. Conundrum Demure on Radio Free Brooklyn. Welcome to episode 264 of Troubadours and Raconteurs with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's program, we feature a conversation with poet, essayist, and digital artist Will Dowd out of Boston, Massachusetts. We talk to Will about how he came into writing. We talk about some of his influences and his book of essays that got a lot of good response, a lot of good criticism. It's titled Areas of Fog. And it came about while he was writing essays about the weather to deal with a bit of writer's block he had. We also talk about some of the folks in the history of American writing who have used weather as a metaphor, going back to Emerson and Thoreau, Frost, Mark Twain, too. We talk about another project he's working on. He has now available on the web called Broadside, and that has to do with short essays written about historical figures, but sharing things about them you probably do not know. And those essays are accompanied by visual pieces that he has created digitally. We talk about writing as a means to be a protagonist day to day in your existence. And also, we talk a bit about feeling like a weirdo.
Yeah, baby.
A great conversation with Will Dowd today on the program. We also have an EW essay titled Enough. Another wonderfully crafted and beautifully read essay by our associate producer and resident essayist Michael Pavese, a.k.a. Uncle Cesare. And that piece is titled Household Saints. And we have a poem called Bathtub. And all of this, as is always the case, is imbued and infused with the energy of several great tunes. So nice to have you with us. Let's get to it. Episode 264 of Troubadours and Raconteurs.
Yeah.
instead of me. Always seems to know the way. Then I look at you, and the world's alright with me. I just one look at you, and I know it's gonna be.
Enough. The air base he was stationed on certainly made them endure the heat. The assistant district attorney position she had just been appointed to elevated her seat in the hierarchy of family, friends, and society. The senior center is too warm in the autumn and too cold in the spring. The weather pattern, natural and cultural and seemingly controlled, greatly affect how we are living our lives, what and how we feel, and what we allow ourselves to be told. The commonality with which instinctively we respond to the climate changes and different precipitation patterns are astoundingly consistent and have been from one generation to the next. I suppose this is a pretext. We are creatures of the sun, the wind and water, the moon. We are dependent on reaction, acceptance, collective direction, and communal circumstance. We too can be emboldened to transcend all of these factors and stimuli when our minds, souls, and hearts can no longer wake up and habitually restart our days in the ways that don't sit well with our core components of existence. The weather we certainly share, observe, and discuss. We are a part of it all. And when we deem it is time, when our better senses tell us, and we then communicate with each other that enough is enough, we shift the winds of time. We stand up and speak. We march together en masse, and our hearts inspire and govern our minds to do what often seems impossible. We alter the climate. We change the patterns. We'll be right back. Hello, is this Will Dowd?
Yes, this is Will Dowd.
Will Dowd.
Is this EW?
It is EW. It's nice to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Before we get started, let me share with the listeners some background information, if you don't mind.
No problem.
Will Dowd, poet, essayist, and digital artist, is a Boston College graduate with a master's degree in fine arts from New York University and a master's degree in science from MIT. He's a tutor who assists students with the college admissions process and an artist whose exhibit of fine art digital prints of words on weighted paper is something to be seen. His collection of essays regarding the weather, titled Areas of Fog, has been well received. Here are some reviews of Areas of Fog. An absolutely beautiful read. That's from WBUR Radio Boston. Quote, the essays are deep, moving, and penetrating, and yet it's still a fun read at the same time. It's a great book, Scott Jones from Give and Take. And quote, an original, highly enjoyable book to be read in all sorts of weather. Buy two copies and give one to a friend. Cease cows. Ladies and gentlemen, Will Dowd on the program. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Thank you for that introduction. That brightened my day. Appreciate it.
No problem. Well, I want to get right in and maybe try to figure out, first of all, how you came into writing.
Oh, wow. Well, I used to dictate stories to my mom, who would write them down before I was able to write. So it's prehistory for me. It's pre-memory. I guess I was like a toddler when I started to put words on paper.
How did she manage to do that? She just, it was like something that was something she needed done, or do you wanted to do it?
Yeah, no, I think I just went into like a trance and started speaking in tongues, you know, some crazy story from my imagination, and she wrote it down because she was amused and befuddled.
That's great. So you're born with this sort of gift or weirdness, whatever you want to call it, right?
Yeah, I think it's a weirdness more than a gift.
And how about some of your background, some of the influences that you have?
Oh, sure. I read compulsively when I was really young. I read a lot of the classics, especially English classics, novels like Peter Pan and the Chronicles of Narnia. And I think that really informed my life and the way I see the world, because I just had my head in a book for most of my early years. And so the reading world is always vying with reality for my attention, and they both feel equally present at all times. So I'm definitely a big reader. Writing is kind of a complementary activity to that. As far as some of my influences that I've picked up over the years, I really like the haiku poet Kobayashi Isa, who wrote 20,000 haiku in his very dismal, dreary, tragic life. And I just love his collected works, because it always gives me hope that even when you're being dragged through the mud of life, you can look for these little snatches of beauty, and they can accumulate. And so he leaves behind this incredible legacy of humor and warmth, despite what his reality was. So yeah, he's a big influence for me.
Oh yeah, I know a bit of his work too. It is. I think you said snatches of beauty that he shares, and yeah, for sure, for certain. And now you're relatively young, I would say. I mean, you're still in your 30s, right?
Yeah, I just had my birthday. I just turned 34 the other week.
Happy birthday.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And in the world of your essays, because we talked about in the introduction that you're a poet and an essayist, you have put together a compilation of essays that you worked on. And I guess from my understanding, it stems from what you described or you called a writer's block that you were experiencing. And you had a bit of a plan to get out of that. And that translated into or turned into this book of essays that I'm referring to. You want to give us a little bit of, the narrative?
Yeah, sure. As you say, I was suffering from a strain of writer's block, and I had plenty of creative energy. I just didn't have a subject. I had come out of you mentioned earlier some of the degrees that I got. I was kind of in school till I was really old. I just never left. And so sometimes when you're in school that long, you can get a lot of other people's voices in your head. And so when you come out, you're a little bit lost as to what you're supposed to do now. You're used to being handed some kind of assignment. So I had a little bit of flailing around after I got out of school. And one day I just hit upon the idea of writing about the weather. I'm a New Englander. I've been a New Englander my whole life. And whenever we don't have anything to talk about, we talk about the weather. It's just kind of our regional tick. And so I decided to take that on and use it. And for every week for a year, I wrote an essay, and it would start with the weather, just a simple weather report. And then it would kind of digress from there. But one of the fun things about it was also I thought at the time, I said, well, this is just an exercise for myself to sort of emancipate myself from this writer's block. Nobody's ever going to read this. There's no pressure. I can write whatever I want. And I absolutely had no idea I was writing a book at the time. And now that it's bound and out in the world, it's kind of amazing to me.
Yeah, that's a great idea. As you said, it's really something that seemingly is an easy subject area to delve into. I mean, there's weather every day. And no matter who you are, you're experiencing it. And New England, as well as where I'm from here in northeastern Pennsylvania, I'm from the Northeast as well, the weather is up and down and all over the place. I mean, as we speak, it's the second day of spring, and we had early dismissal because of snow. You know, so yeah, we sit back and talk about the weather. So it's something common. It connects us. I understand based on some of what I read, you grabbed onto some great observations when looking at your surroundings and people like protecting their parking spots from being taken after they shovel them out. You want to share some of what you saw there?
There's something called the Southie Parking Wars. Well, at least that's how I dub it. But in South Boston, parking is limited and always a source of headache for people who live there trying to find a spot. And it gets extremely contentious when there's a blizzard, because if you shovel out your spot and then leave, somebody else can take advantage of all your hard work. And so what people do is they leave objects in the spots that they've shoveled out to try to stake their claim. And so, yeah, one of the essays I wrote during, I think it was February of that year, I was writing about what kind of objects people like to leave in those spots. And you have sometimes cones, which makes sense. Those are kind of official. But you also have, lawn chairs and ironing boards and just like, old boots or something. And I kind of was trying to come up with the psychology behind each choice. Like, okay, maybe, an open lawn chair kind of conjures the idea that somebody, the owner's sitting there watching you, ready to spring if you take the spot. So yeah, I've definitely enjoyed writing about the weather, because it does bring in all of our kind of regional quirks. I wrote about how we're being taken over by turkeys in the fall. And so, yeah, I was able to kind of just cast my eye at things that maybe pass by on the evening news without much comment and really try to dig into them and see what kind of fun I can have.
Yeah, that's exactly, I think, the best way, from my experience, to write. There's so much that is overlooked that when you have that ability to not overlook it, to see, the complexity or the weirdness or the poignant aspects of it, it's almost an unlimited amount you can write then.
Yes, exactly. And when I started this year-long weather journal, it was sort of on a whim, but as I went, I realized just what a central role the weather plays in the New England literary history. It's because it's this kind of common canvas that we all have access to. It's been used by our writers and thinkers for centuries as a way to discuss big, small questions, but also big questions, big metaphysical questions. You can think of Emerson or Thoreau or Dickinson or Frost, all using the weather, extremely well and in depth as kind of metaphorical ammunition to talk about their man's place in the universe, man's relationship to God. And then if you go even further back, you've got, of course, the Puritans, and their sermons and diaries were full of weather, and they really saw the weather as God's, voice, God, the way God sort of spoke and declared his approval or disapproval of whatever people were doing. So I think that, weather can feel kind of frivolous and like, empty filler in our conversations, but there's a kind of hidden depth to it.
Yeah. Even when you're talking to someone and their take on the weather, like I said, if they're really down and they're looking at the weather, a snowstorm is just oppressive, and the cold is something that they can hardly take anymore. And when they're describing, their interpretation of what's going on with the weather, that's clear that, they're down. But if they look at a snowstorm as, wow, it's so beautiful, so clear, it's so bright, it's so clean, I love it, I can't wait to go play. Now, that represents their sense of, being joyous or for whatever reason about their life.
Yeah, I think you're right. Mark Twain wrote a lot about the weather, and famously, the quote is attributed to him: "Everybody complains about the weather, but nobody does anything about it." But his take on New England weather was that, you know, we're put through a year of hell, but it's all worth it for one, you know, winter afternoon when the sun comes out and shines through a tree that's been encased in ice, and the sunlight kind of comes through prismatic through the clarity of the tree and creates this kind of dazzling halo. And that to me is a great example of finding beauty in any weather. And you're right, we do sort of, our moods are projected onto the weather as much as the weather projects onto us. And yeah, I think Twain got that pretty well.
Oh yeah, he usually does.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking to Will Dowd on the program, Troubadours and Rock on Tours, and discussing a bit about his book of essays titled Areas of Fog, and how weather is a great common canvas and often used as a metaphor over the whole time, basically, of our existence as a species. Weather is a common reference point. Now, well, when you finished up the essays and you put them together and put them out as a book, you got some positive response, and you know, I read some of the reviews earlier, and now, you know, I'm sure you are continuing with more projects, and I'm wondering, do you write now because of any reason in particular, like you must write for a spiritual sort of intellectual health that you're trying to achieve, or do you do it mainly to make ends meet financially? Why do you write still?
I write because if I don't, I feel a kind of subcutaneous angst. You know, I just seems to be something I have to do. I really enjoy it. And if I'm, I don't know, somehow it seems like the way I communicate with people the best. And so not writing is like not talking, you know, it's like a vow of silence. If I was to not write, it's not a lot of fun. So yeah, so I just have, it's just kind of part of my makeup at this point. Maybe it's an obsession, I don't know, but yeah, definitely a day doesn't go by when I don't think about it quite a bit.
And what about, you know, being able to, is that make your financial ends meet? Is that a big concern when you're thinking about the prospects of writing?
Yeah, absolutely, like anything else. But I mean, this weather book is an example that I was interested in kind of finding my voice and staking out, discovering kind of my own writing territory and what that's going to be and what works. I still feel at the beginning stages of that. And so, if I was, I think if I had my eyes on fame and riches, I probably wouldn't have written about the weather for this book. I did that because it felt right to me artistically, and I was interested in it, and I thought it was going to be an enjoyable time. Maybe in the future I will write something that connects with, you know, that connects with a huge audience and makes me a bunch of money. But I'm not holding my breath for that. I'm trying to just put one foot in front of the other.
Oh, the reason I ask is because a lot of aspiring writers, you know, some of them might be thinking they're going to make it rich from writing, and maybe that is a driving force for them. And I like asking writers how they deal with the reality. Anybody who knows anything, you're not likely to get rich from writing. How are you, you know, I was curious to how you would respond to that so those folks can hear your response. And to me, it seems you're writing because you love it, because you need to. And if you make some money, great, but that's not what it's about.
You are listening to Troubadours and Rock on Tours with E.W. Conundrum Demure on Radio Free Brooklyn.
That's true, exactly. To me, it really comes from writing is to me a kind of at once a social activity and also an introspective activity, and it's a way of communicating to other people and trying to communicate from a really deep place in myself. And so, how that converts into dollars is really unclear. I think there's a lot of chance to it. And I mean, it's also extremely indirect. I wrote this, this weather journal for a year. Then right after I finished it, I had surgery and, I was kind of wrapped up in that. So it wasn't until a year later that I thought about putting them together and maybe seeing if they're a book. And then I sent it out and then it's another year before it gets published. So, I mean, there is no clear one-to-one direct, okay, I've written this, you know, hand me my money. It doesn't seem to work that way. And, there's a lot of other ways you can make money a lot quicker and more direct. I don't, unless you're writing, you know, the next Da Vinci Code, I don't think it would be, I think it, you should see it as a pleasant surprise if money does, arrive back, from the effort you put in.
Yeah. Well put.
To me, I'm just excited if people read it.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear you. That would make me very happy as well. Now my associate producer, Dr. Pavese, he put on this list of things to talk with you about, and I didn't do any research on it. I overlooked it totally. It says, ask him about art project Broadsides.
I have this kind of ongoing art project, which I have some of them up on my website, which is willdow.net. For a while I've been writing. It's kind of like a word art project. It's got... each piece is sort of a microbiography from a historical figure that I'm inspired by. And there's a research and writing aspect to it. And then there's a kind of the visual aspect to it where I'm making it into an art object. It's been really fun. It's part of the reason why I haven't just decided to make them, you know, a book of poems or something, why I pushed them into something visual is I'm really interested in, creating a different kind of reading experience and playing with the way we read and the way the eye takes in information and how we sort of interact. And to me, there's an analogy with, I think, how we interact with the dead and with historical figures. I think a lot of times they become sort of two-dimensional to us. They're sort of these statues. We stop seeing them as actual human beings with flaws and imperfections. And so I'm kind of interested in almost hopefully subverting and making fresh figures that you're used to reading about on plaques. So, yeah, if people check it out, I would be curious to see what people think. I've gotten some good responses so far. You can contact me through my website if you like them. I'm making more of them as I go, just slowly as I go.
And again, that's Will, W-I-L-L, Dowd, D-O-W-D.net.
You got it.
Okay, and can you give me a more specific example of what one would find when they're checking out Broadsides on your website? What would they see?
Oh, sure. So each one takes a different historical figure and then tells some kind of story about them. The stories are all factually true, but they're all sort of, I mean, these are really well-trod biographies. Like I'm talking about people like Da Vinci and Frida Kahlo, you know, people who are household names. But what I'm trying to do is find things in their biography, find shapes in their life that are fresh and different and that haven't really been brought to the fore. And so giving you a different angle on someone who you might already have a kind of iconic conception of them in your mind and sort of like the anti-Wikipedia, something you're not going to find just in the kind of generic knowledge of who this person is, and hopefully something that makes them a little more human and maybe connects them to you a little bit stronger.
Is there something that pops into your head that you found that you shared on Broadsides, like regarding Da Vinci or Frida Kahlo?
Yeah, sure. They're pretty quick. They're almost read like poems. I could read you the Da Vinci one if you care to hear it.
Sure.
That might be fun. Sure. So let me just grab it. It's right here. Okay. So this is obviously you won't have the visual component, but this will give you an idea of what I'm talking about, which I think will be valuable. So this is, it starts, Leonardo da Vinci worked his whole life for rich men, designing giant crossbows, fleur-de-lis fortresses, mechanical lions that could vomit flowers, He also worked for himself, filling notebooks with beautiful, erroneous ideas. The surface of the moon, he wrote in one, is covered by a vast luminous sea. Today that notebook is kept in a dark, airlocked vault in the Medina home of Bill Gates. So there's the, yeah, so there's a little slice about Da Vinci, a sort of ironic end for one of his personal notebooks. Again, I'm just sort of reading it. I'm curious to see what people think when they see the visual, because I think that, you know, that's part of the conception of it. So, yeah, thanks for your interest in it, though. I'm hopeful. I'm hoping to keep doing them until I can accumulate enough for more art exhibits and possibly a book someday.
It's a fascinating idea. Now, the visual is something that you created or something you just kind of found that, you know, comes from Da Vinci himself and you attached to what you wrote?
No, it's something I created and designed. So the visuals don't have any, like, any of Da Vinci's works directly, but his notebooks kind of inform the design of it.
And it's a digital creation.
Yes, it's a digital creation. Exactly. I would love to have a press that I could create these broadsides. Maybe someday. I've been looking into it, but alas, I don't have access to one yet. But someday it would be really fun to create them in the old way.
Wow, and I mean, it sounds like it'd be hard to do something like that in the old way. You know?
Yeah, there are people. Believe it or not, there are hardcore. Printing press people out there who have incredible skills and still keep it alive as an art form.
Yeah. Well, I love this. I wish you luck with it. I'm going to check it out myself. Again, that's willdowd.net that you can find the Broadsides Art Project. Now, we have just a couple of minutes left. What about... telling us what you hope to accomplish with all this work, Will Dowd?
I think one of the things that I'm hoping to accomplish is just one of the reasons I love writing is because it makes you pay attention more to your own life. As I mentioned at the beginning of this interview, I was a intense reader, and so I always feel like I have one foot in another world. And so writing about this world keeps me more engaged. And I think that was one of the reasons I loved keeping the weather journal and continuing to write. I think it makes me a more active participant and protagonist in my day-to-day. And I actually think that's something that we can all work on, because I think as we kind of interface with technology, we sort of are starting to crowd out those moments of reflection, those moments of where we're kind of cascading down a series of thoughts, one leading to the other. I think we're sort of short-circuiting that, because, I mean, I'm guilty of it too. It's like if you have a quiet moment in line at the store, you know, out comes your phone or whatever. So, yeah, I think writing and just general mindfulness is a way to stay engaged with your actual reality.
Oh, yes. Well put. And I try to do the same thing. The other day I was waiting for my children to come out of an activity I had dropped them off at, and everybody, I was standing outside, everybody was on their phones, and I was just looking at the sky and looking at, you know, the trees and, you know, the landscape and the houses around the area. And for a second I felt like a weirdo because I was the only one doing it, you know. I felt like an oddball, right? Where when I was 10, yeah, that was the normal thing to do.
I know. Now you're like the only, you've just woken up and everybody else is still asleep. Yeah.
Wonderful talking with you. I'd love to have you on the show again. Thank you for taking time out.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Any closing insight or suggestion for the throngs of listeners?
Yeah, stay warm. There's another nor'easter slouching its way towards Boston as we speak. You're getting it right now, I think. So we've only got a couple more weeks of this, guys.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Will Dowd.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye. Color.
Household Saints. My mother prayed every day. She said the rosary at night after dinner, watching the news or a game show, shuffling the yellowing prayer cards picked up at the viewings she regularly attended. She prayed for the dead, her parents, her husband, her friends, eventually her sister, and she prayed for the living, her children, her sister, her nieces and nephews, her remaining friends, and her neighbors. Well, maybe not all of her neighbors. She prayed to her favorite saints, an all-star team awaiting her imprecations. My mother was as familiar with the saints as she was with the surly, burly grocer at the store a few blocks from our house, and the kindly mechanic who kept her used cars running, and the drowsy doctor who watched her blood pressure, and the parish priests who serviced her soul. She might have been closer to the saints than she was to any of the priests who served their terms and moved on to another parish. There were the go-to saints, on heavy rotation in our house, St. Anthony and St. Jude. Anthony is the patron saint of lost and stolen articles, a saint of daily crisis management. So when my brother would be tearing around the house, cursing and searching for his keys, my mother would ask, a little reproachfully, "Did you pray to St. Anthony?" The implication being that, one, St. Anthony would help you find them, and two, it's your own damn fault if you misplace them, and don't blame Anthony if you can't find them. St. Jude, the patron saint of lost causes, was a runner-up to Anthony. Not because he was invoked as often, but because he sort of hovered around our tiny house, checking in on the prayers of the girl who was raised during the Depression with a drunken, feckless house-painter father, and the woman who was widowed at 44 with 5 young children. I think my mother kept St. Jude in the back of her mind in hopes that we didn't end up as lost causes ourselves. She had other favorites. St. Gerard, the patron saint of pregnant women, to whom she prayed when expecting me. St. Joseph, the stepfather of Jesus, the patron saint of the dying, and there was always a lot of dying to pray over, as well as the patron saint of travelers, immigrants, and working people. St. Michael, the saint of warriors, but also the sick and the suffering. My mother was also fond of St. Teresa of Lisieux, the little flower. One pope called her the greatest saint of modern times, although ranking saints seems a little odd in this spiritual context, as if the other saints were also Rans. St. Teresa, who died at 24 from tuberculosis, is the patron saint of the sick. Mother Cabrini, the first U.S. citizen to be canonized, spent her life caring for the poor, orphans, the abandoned, and, in particular, Italian immigrants. You begin to see a theme with my mother's saints. Immigrants and orphans, the sick and the dying, the lost and the hopeless. A precarious life watched over and protected by a group of kind intermediaries. Her all-time favorite was Saint Anne, the mother of Mary, the mother of Jesus. Saint Anne has a roll call of patronage. Broom makers, carpenters, old clothes dealers, equestrians, lace workers, miners, and childless people. The poor childless were surrounded by the ferociously fecund Irish and Italian families in our neighborhood. Equestrians weren't much in view, but we had a lace factory in town. And of course, as a depressed former coal town, we had generations of miners sorely in need of saintly intervention. But it was St. Anne's role as protector of mothers that most appealed to my mother. She was fond of her own mother, and she always prefaced stories of the long-suffering woman keeping a house together during the Depression with no help from her pickled husband with my poor mother. It was good to know that Anne was looking out for mothers. Hers, mine, yours. Our house had its share of holy objects, statues and crucifixes. We had a death kit crucifix for the service of the dying, extreme unction. It opened up into a mini altar with a candle holder. We had a picture of the Infant of Prague and a sepia portrait of young Jesus. We had prayer cards and saint cards galore, some of which wound up in a junk drawer. One card, which endlessly fascinated and repelled me, had a gruesome image of Jesus covered with bleeding sores. Our most distinctive venerable object was a large statue of the Blessed Virgin Mary, daughter of Anne, wife of Joseph, mother of Jesus. Sometime in the past, the statue must have fallen, and Mary's hands had broken off, leaving two wires jutting out in a threatening sort of supplication. She looked like a vandalized statue from a scene in The Exorcist. Despite this disfigurement, my mother kept her on display, on a table overlooking the stairs to the second floor of our house. At night, Mary cast a spooky shadow on the wall.
Fernando.
bathtub. Lying in the bathtub, naked with joy, as the hot water with bubbles covers your body, but for your protruding nipples, hard, your neck soft, and the wonderful, unique beauty of the incredible head that is home to those piercing eyes, a voice with soulful timbre beyond compare, and a nose of perfect curve and proportion, your ears and hair with eyebrows exquisitely juxtaposed, strong and beautifully symmetric. There you have it, episode 264 of Troubadours and Rock on Tours, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, poet, essayist, and digital artist Will Dowd, our associate producer and resident essayist Dr. Michael Pavese, a.k.a. Uncle Cesare, and of course, these musical artists: Stefan Grappelli, Django Reinhardt, Bill Withers, Stevie Ray Vaughan, 10,000 Maniacs, Jenny Lewis, Terrence Blanchard, and Branford Marsalis, too. Thanks so much for listening. Until next week, enjoy this one. Take care.